Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to our 1970s rap party. We enjoyed ourselves so much, we thought we deserved a bit of a rap party. Party food all over the place. We have vol-au-vents, mushroom, obviously. There's a bit of Angel Delight for dessert. There's cheese and pickled onions on a stick. And obviously a prawn ring is on the way. Dave's brought the Watney Party 7. David, who we'll introduce fully very soon, has brought the Cinzano and the Martini. And Paul's been responsible for the Blue Nun, which, you know, it's completely and utterly
apt. A fine job.
And I've raided my dad's alcohol cabinet for the Quantro, Matthias Rosa. Snowball, Cherry B, Avocat and the Croft Originals, everything that was left over from Christmas. So it's got to be a bit of it'll be a well-fed and boozy evening, shall we say. For music, mood music, we've got Jose Feliciano and a bit of Demis Roussos. That Dave will add in during editing, I'm sure. To welcome the full team and give them the big build-up. Dave Bowler, welcome, Dave. It wouldn't be right if you weren't here tonight.
Thank you kindly. It's been a great series. I've been just editing the very last one today, and it's a fitting finale. But I think we've done the 70s proud out of the piece.
It has. It's been an absolute joy to do. Paul McParlan, welcome, Paul. And again, exactly the same. It wouldn't be right to do this, to throw the party without you.
And wouldn't be the same about you here, Stephen, as well. And it's good to be to have made it to the VIP list for the 1970s rap party. Really looking forward to this one. And as the saying goes, I'm going to party like it's 1971, 72, 73, and so on.
Excellent. As the party goes on, I'm sure we'll be joined by Shawaddy Waddy and the Grumbleweeds, hopefully Elton John at some point too. And last but by no means least, the wonderful David Turner, who came and joined us for 1975-76, devoted supporter of Queen's Park Rangers, but also, you know, in his day job, senior lecturer in sports coaching at Anglia Ruskin University, and also a member of the Cambridge Centre for Sport and Exercise Science Research. And David, welcome again.
Thank you. It was great to guest, and it'd be really nice to wrap up this trip back to the 70s, which I've been immersed in ever since. So it's been lovely going back and revisiting those memories. More about that later.
Oh, fantastic. Looking forward to this so much. But yes, you know, the football has brought this podcast together. It is very much a decade that, I don't know, it swings from the heavy kits of the early 1970s to Admiral doing battle with Umbro. There's the difference between the big, heavier, massive footballs, the like medicine balls of the early part of the decade, to the Adidas Tango that is so resplendent at the end of it. You know, we're sneaking into an era where shirt sponsorship is nearby. Colour television has really took control and made a big difference to televised football in this decade. It's not all been good. Hooliganism has been rampant. And there's been pain to go with the pleasure somewhat. In sociological terms, to start with, I think, the 1970s, David, Dr. David, as I will refer to you tonight. Your thoughts on 1970s football, you know, and the social impact of the game throughout the decade?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time sociologically. It's interesting you put your finger on that. And I'm trying to use a sociological lens to write a paper on the QPR season. But in many ways, some of those factors that I'm looking at in that for one season apply to the decade. It's a turning point. I think the 70s is a turning point. You know, if I look back on the 70s, I think uneven playing surfaces, level playing field. But things started to change very shortly after that. So in terms of turning points, we can think about English managers and how successful they were. From 76 onwards till 85, I think it was, every manager that won the league was English. Thereafter, only two managers that won the league were English, and none since 1992. And I think there was this change between amateurism, maybe not amateurism, the amateur spirit and professionalism. You know, we had the Mavericks who starred in this decade, but we don't have Mavericks starring thereafter. And it was the age where we flirted with Maverick talent. And it's a decade where we flirted with individualism and rebellion, didn't we? With 1977 punk, etc. So there's some interesting parallels, I think, going on sociologically. But I won't hog things. I'll let people else come in and say what they think too.
I mean, Paul, great points there from David. You know, this is the decade that swept through. That, you know, the National Front came to the fore, you know, painfully. You know, political upheaval. You know, two general elections in 1974 alone. You know, the decade that, you know, David Wright points out that punk. The rise of punk, having gone through prog rock and glam rock. You know, the end of the psychedelia era. You know, from the demise, not the demise, but the disbanding of the Beatles at the beginning of the decade, all the way through to, you know, the rise of new romanticism through, you know, the disco rise as well. Such a varied decade. And on the football terraces from about 1977, actually, the casual movement as well. It covers a vast gamut of, you know, social uprising and changes. It's one hell of a tectonic plate of a decade, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think David touched on something there with about the amateur aspect of football, because I think the Amateur Cup, that was one, was in 1974, and that was quite a keynote of how football was beginning to change as well. It's such a topsy-turvy decade, and we've said in lots of introductions each season, no, there hasn't been a season like it. I don't think there's quite been a decade like the 70s, you know, since. It was unique in so many ways. As you touched upon there, Stephen, first time most has got to watch football in colour. Speaking from my own personal perspective, you know, it was a decade when I started going to football matches by myself. It was a decade when I started going to away matches by myself. I learned to perfect a Cockney accent to ensure I got to London in one piece. It was, you know, you just accepted that as part of the day out, that, you know, you had to plan the strategy to get to the ground, get back, you know, keep your mouth shut, make sure it's safe. But once you got back home to the safety of your pub, you know, but to make last orders at 10:30, you sit around and talk about the real sense of achievement, which I don't think quite get goes away much as these days. But as a decade, yeah, it was all over the place, wasn't it? You know, you got the miners' strike, you got the 3-day week, you got the power cut, you got Sunday football for the first time. Just touching upon a few things there. As you mentioned, musically, you know, the decade starts off on a downer with the Beatles disbanding, but then, you know, different forms of vibe and music, such as punk, kick in to kickstart the decade as well. It was still in an era when if you went to a football game, the pubs were closed between 3 and 5. On Sunday, the pubs were closed from 2 to 7. So, and those of you, if you grew up in the 70s, the Easter weekend was the weekend you dreaded amongst all, because it was just 3 days in non-stop religious programs, and you were never been so desperate to get to a football game on Easter Saturday and Easter Monday to kind of break with the routine of that as well. And also, in terms of the rebellion aspect, there was the time when Foul magazine hit the shelves for the first time. Such a fantastic, iconic magazine that never quite gets name-checked as often as it should do, but it was the first time you had almost like an intellectual element of football with this group of young writers at Cambridge, knocking all the icons of football and giving a real alternative look at what the game was going through. David, you mentioned about the Mavericks. It was the era of the Mavericks. You know, Frank Webster, Alan Hudson, Stan Bowles, the names rolled off the tongue, didn't they? But, you know, you're never going to see those likes again. I mean, Stan Bowles in particular, Dave, you know, putting on the manager wonder where he is at 5-3. He's just got back from the bookies, has to put the best on before the game. You just couldn't do that now. And you know, what a fabulous, unique time it was. So, yeah, a brilliant decade, which we touched upon season by season. And I'll stop now, otherwise I could talk for 2 hours.
And that would be absolutely fine with us, Paul. Absolutely fine. Hey, Dave, you know, everything that David and Paul have touched on there, I mean, I'll throw Maverick into the mix there in Rodney Marsh, you know, and his assertion that, you know, English football in the 1970s was a grey sport played in grey stadiums by grey men. You know, I think everything he described as being grey at the time. How wrong can one talented person be?
Extremely wrong. I think Paul's right. I mean, we've missed a trick here. The sociology of it should be another podcast, actually, all on its own. I always think that, you know, sport, and particularly football in this country, is just a mirror of the society that it lives in. And I think all the stuff that, that David and Paul have said is absolutely true. I think the 70s is the turning point in everything. We haven't mentioned it by name, and I'm not going to, but not in May 1979, something happened and the country's never been the same since. And you can make your own conclusions as to whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. I think this was, you know, the Maverick thing is interesting because I think it's the Maverick thing across everything. You know, I think there were Maverick MPs, there were Mavericks on the television, there were Mavericks in other sports and any other forms of, you know, other walks of life. And I think as you get to the 1980s, everything becomes a lot more serious because everything becomes governed by money. The stakes become higher because, you know, in the 70s, you never used to talk about, oh, that missed penalty has cost that club X million pounds or X hundred thousand pounds or whatever it is. Now, that's all that you hear about. That's why we have to have VAR because, you know, if a decision goes wrong, it's going to cost somebody an enormous amount of money. That wasn't the point in the 70s. And I think as you're coming towards the 70s, freedom of contract changes, which changes the transfer market, which then begins to put more money in footballers' pockets and makes for the bigger transfers and all of that. And I think the 70s, in a sense, is the... I mean, I called it the age of innocence, but it's sort of the age of the end of the age of innocence, except on the terraces where people are kicking the crap out of one another. That's another story. But I think it is. I think it's that final point where, you know, I mean, David obviously talked a lot about QPR in that episode, and we've talked about Derby County, Nottingham Forest, teams like that being able to come along and have a go, and the level playing field and all that stuff, and that really doesn't go on for very much longer beyond the 70s. I think it all begins to change as the money starts to take more and more effect, and the game becomes a bit more corporate and all of those elements. I think that's why particularly at our kind of age, you look back on the 70s with such a, yeah, of course it's rose-tinted glasses, but equally I think there was such a lot in the 70s that stopped at that point and never came back. And we've lost, footballers gained a great deal since then in all kinds of ways, but it also lost a lot from what we had in the 1970s. I think this series hopefully has shown to people, reminded people, shown people who weren't there. But I do think David's right, this is absolutely the turning point. You know, you get to 79 and you suddenly move off into another world. I think that's the big point.
David, as the decade goes, I think it's one of these is that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but it doesn't completely have to be that way. I mean, this is clearly, you know, what's been great about this, doing this series through all 10 episodes has been the pure joy that everyone's had in talking about it. It's clearly the decade, you know, and that's one of the best things that what I've tried to hopefully be a part of in this series is to prompt everyone to you know, come forth with the I don't know, anecdotes, their opinions of certain seasons and what it meant to them and that passion that comes through. But what's been interesting is that some of the feedback that we've had on the series is particularly from people who the 70s was before their time, and that they've love the series, you know, because it's just, you know, it's felt like the way that they've put it across is that they've, I don't know, we filled the gaps in a way and you know, helped them kind of like understand the 70s a lot more than they previously did. The concept though, however, of, you know, being your decade, you know, what does the 70s mean to you in both football in terms and in social terms?
Wow, that's a long answer going to be for that one. But I'll pick up on something Dave said first of all, which is I feel that there was a kind of sense of adventure in the 70s that we haven't got now. So QPR going into the top division for the second time in their history, but they're only there briefly before. There was a sense of adventure about that project. But I don't want to be too provincial. I was reading and listening about Clough's Nottingham Forest, and that exactly the same thing. And the Texaco Cup was a catalyst for them for their future successes, because they went on tour to places like Kilmarnock and had a sense of adventure about it. That's something we've definitely lost. When I talk about the amateur ethos, I don't mean being unprofessional. I mean having a love for the game, having a love for the project. you know, and the tour, etc., that sort of thing. So that's something about it. But going back to your big question was about what does the 70s mean to me, I think. You know, 70-71 was my first season supporting a club. I was brought up in Islington, and my parents kept telling me to go and play football in the big park out the back. And for your cultural references, Stephen, the only things that were sold in pubs in those days were arrowroot biscuits and pickled eggs, right? That was all you got. So they would encourage me to go and play football, wouldn't go and play, a bit shy, etc. Guy turns up in the late 60s with a new telly. And hey, presto, it's colour. And the first match that comes on is the big match. Their problem now is getting me in to eat something. So had to learn to support a team. So first season, 70-71, that I remember. Don't remember the 70 World Cup. But I was 9 years old and I started supporting Arsenal. I was in Islington. Dad would take me over there to watch the team. I watched Frank McClintock marshal a back four, which was masterful. And I guess it's my first engagement with football that now I've been playing for more than 50 years and I've been privileged to be a coach as well. And I educate coaches now. I just put up on Twitter that four of my recent former students are at four different academies, just started jobs. And that's a lovely legacy. So this was the first engagement I had with football. So that's how much it means to me. And I guess, you know, you asked about favourite football seasons and you probably think 75, 76, but no, it's 70, 71, because that was me and my dad going and watching football. So that's a memory of being a kid with your dad as well. And your dad pointing out something in football and you starting to appreciate Frank McClintock's leadership.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I mean, Paul, same question to you. The 70s, you're in Yorkshire as a student in the mid-70s. So, you know, you run through a decade there and what it means to you as an Everton fan and as a football lover in general as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think as we've all touched upon it, the 70s was just a superb decade to watch football, and it was a type of football, type of spirit about it that maybe has not been repeated since. Kind of speaking personally, I always felt quite privileged, really, because in my last couple of years at school before I went to Leeds, obviously I was watching Everton, but I also had a fan who was a mate who was a fanatical Chelsea fan. I went to watch Chelsea a few times with him as well, which is a whole different experience. And that meant I got to see in 1970 Cup final, we played Old Trafford, which, you know, it lives me to this day. And then I had 4 years at Leeds as well. My first year there was when Revy won the lead in 73-74. So it was another insight into... what really struck me about that was the power of the media, even at that age, because I'd read so much anti-Leeds stuff that I was imbued with anti-Leeds stuff. When I actually went there and stood with their fans, I'm like, hang on, this isn't right. This team is okay. You know, they play some decent football here. I think they've been quite wrongly maligned. One of my overriding memories of the 70s, I'm just talking about going to away games, is hitchhiking to away games, which you just wouldn't do anymore. So standing, you know, everyone's get back from Leeds to Liverpool, standing on the M62, sticking my thumb out, and just, you know, by, you know, getting back to Merseyside, taking some various psychopaths and mental patients, but it all kind of worked in the end. But it's something now, if you suggest to a young, you know, adolescent teenager, yeah, it's sick for the game. Why don't you hitch there, go stand on the M1 and see if you can get a lift to the game, okay? So that kind of experience has gone as well. It's just... In terms of being a footballing adult, certainly came more of age in the 70s. As we've asked before, the Foul magazine was really influential for me to give me a new insight, because if you brought up Shoot and Go, Charles Bukeman's Football Monthly, you're given the traditional view about football, and it's just good to have that alternative look at how football could and should be. Overriding negative memory of the 70s, you've just won the hooliganism element there, Stephen, but also custom care didn't exist as a fan in the 70s. You know, if an important cup tie was coming up, you'd have to queue for about 12 hours outside the stadium and start a chance to get the tickets. And for the FA Cup final, you're close to giving an allocation of 12,000, you know, in a 100,000 stadium. You'd be locked out of games sometimes. You wouldn't be able to gain entry. And the crushing, the pushing, you know, coming out sometimes wondering how on earth you got out alive, but it still kind of sticks with me to this day. So, yeah, lots of positives, but also, you know, there were some, you know, you used Roddy Marsh's quote before, and I could see that compared to the American experience, it's completely different. I remember going to America for the first time in 1979, went to see San Diego Soccer's play, and the experience there was I sat in a chair, I could order a beer, and a beer was brought to me, and I have a burger brought to me. I was sitting in comfort, there were colours of TV screens around the place, and I was looking about, why is no football like this? You know, I mean, the quality of football on the pitch is awful, don't get me wrong, but the actual way I was treated as a fan was a real eye-opener.
Excellent, excellent answer. And Dave, same to you. The 1970s from a West Brom perspective and a football, wider football living perspective.
I was born in 64, so I was 5 as the decade started in 15. As it finished, you couldn't really get a much more sort of perfect run of years for that, I suppose. I mean, I do remember the 1970 World Cup. I remember it quite well. It's a bizarre, I don't remember much else, but I remember the 1970 World Cup. And the weird thing is, I mean, I still see it in colour, I suppose, because we've seen it all since then. We didn't get a colour set till 1975, so God knows what I've got the colour pictures from. But, you know, I remember running home from school at dinner time because they had World Cup grandstand on at like 12:30 or something. From Mexico, I remember running home to watch that. And then, yeah, it was just a decade where there was always stuff happening. You know, there was always something interesting happening. You know, you had, and we talked about this a lot, but, you know, the FA Cup final was such a big event. And I think, you know, Paul's absolutely right with all the things he says about so many things have improved. You know, I mean, the stadiums were falling down around us, not that we'd really noticed that much at the time. And it's a much better experience and all those kinds of things. But, I mean, this sounds stupid for a football fan, but it was a great thing that you didn't get much football on television. Because, you know, it's the same with music and it's the same with films, it's the same with everything now. There's no scarcity value and there's no effort involved in doing anything anymore, you know. Think about music. If you wanted somebody's new album, you had to get on the bus on a Saturday, you had to go into the town, you had to, you know, go and save up your pocket money or whatever it was. And then come back, and you know, that would be the only record that you'd got, and you wouldn't be buying another one for another 6 weeks or whatever till you'd saved up, and you worked on that record. And it now I can have every record that's ever been released pretty much with the click of a mouse, and there we are. I can just do anything I want. Same with film, same with everything, you know, books on Kindle and all of that. And it's the same with football. Football was, you either went to the game, you got a little bit of football on Match of the Day on a Saturday night, you got a little bit on the Sunday dinner time on whichever the regional star soccer, the big match, whatever it was. And then it was the cup final, that was it. And that was all you ever saw. And I think that scarcity value just makes everything, that's why you remember it, you know, because it was such a rare thing. Whereas now, you know, you watch football every night. You can probably watch 2 games a night, most nights of the week if you feel like it. There's no, that sort of specialness as disappearing, you know. Also, I'm far too old to care now, so that's another thing. But you know, that essence of what the football was, because it was such a rare thing, you saw so little of it. I think, you know, that was what made the 70s such a special period, you know, in my memory. And then it was, you know, an era where there was so many ridiculous things happening. Hereford, you know, Sunderland beating Leeds in the cup final, that cup final in 1970, the Chelsea Leeds one, you know, the 1970 World Cup, total football in the 1974 World Cup, the 1978 with the ticker tape, Nottingham Forest, Brian Clough, Bill Shankly. And again, I think that comes back to David's original point about Mavericks. That sort of stuff was still allowed in the 70s because, well, why not? We didn't take it all so seriously, I don't think, in those days as we do now. It was more, I just think it was a bit more fun. And, you know, the 80s came along and I think money had a part to play in that. Obviously, all the tragedies of the 80s as well, you know, the Bradford and Hillsborough and Isle and all of that changed the character of everything around football inevitably as it had to. And, you know, thank God we all had stadiums that we could go in where we'd be, you know, relatively safe. The 70s, we didn't know any of that sort of thing could happen, really. But obviously, them at Ibrox. But, you know, we were in a bubble where, well, it'll all be okay. Didn't worry. That's kind of what I remember about the 1970s. It'll be all right in the finish. How wrong was I?
Fantastic. All fantastic answers. I mean, Dave mentions the FA Cup final. David, I'm going to come to you first. It's Cup final day. BBC or ITV?
I can't remember, but now I would say BBC, but I can't remember, to be honest. But I do remember how special FA Cup final day was. And to this day, when I'm not injured, I'm sitting here with a hamstring injury, I will arrange a group of mates and we'll play Cup Final morning and then go and watch the game together and have a beer. And that's been a tradition for years because it was such a big day. You know, you didn't just watch the Cup Final. You got up early and you watched the route to the Cup Final for each of the teams. You watched them travelling from the hotel to Wembley, etc. You know, it was a real cultural event. It wasn't just a game of football. I can't remember exactly. I'll guess at BBC, but it was a very big thing.
It was, yeah, absolutely huge. Paul, David Coleman or Brian Moore?
I think Brian Moore, to me, was always a better commentator out of the two. But like David, I'd always watched the BBC for the FA Cup final coverage, mainly because it didn't have the adverts. And I think the BBC coverage might have started slightly earlier as well. I'm sure ITV squeezed in wrestling at some stage, but you couldn't have watched your Saturday there was some big McManus before the Cup final. But yeah, I mean, David's right about the importance of the FA Cup in society, not just football fans. I think anyone, it's almost like the Grand National in some ways, that people who don't like horse racing watch the Grand National. People who didn't like football would watch the football just for the events and the spectacle. And I know from my own personal point of view, when I was growing up, it was a tradition amongst my dad and his friends that every year they would go down to watch the Cup Final at Wembley, no matter who played, they'd go on the Friday, come back on the Sunday. So when I was a young kid at primary school, it was the biggest weekend of my life because I couldn't wait until my dad got back on Sunday night with the programme, the rosettes, the hats, the newspaper used to give out, and all these souvenirs from the Wembley game. And I'd always listen to their stories about how they managed to get in without tickets, you know, what wheeling and dealing went on outside the ground to gain in. All the scams that they pulled. So that was a real eye on the two of me as well. But yeah, the FA Cup experience, you know, the day itself, I think, you know, I mean, David's indicated a routine that he still has now. Certainly, when we were young, you'd owe me for a lunchtime pint in the pub before you went back to watch the game. You watched the game, and then depending on what you planned with the evening, you'd all meet up after the game and talk it through. And I know. Dave in particular agrees with me on this, but the way the FA Cup final has declined in status, the way it's declined in importance, the way it's declined as a spectacle, just really, you know, it brings tears to my eye. And the build-up was fantastic in giving you a sense of occasion. Now when it's kind of shoved away, shoehorned into 4:30 on a Saturday afternoon or whenever it kicks off, it makes it impossible for any Northern fans to get to the stadium at the back end of the day. I just think they've really lost something. And I'm sure whatever the rights and wrongs were about the degrading of the FA Cup, football history, football and extinct society has lost something by the downgrading of the FA Cup, in my opinion.
All excellent points. And Dave, Dickie Davis or Frank Booth?
You're not allowed to mention Frank Booth, are you?
No.
Given that it was Frank Booth handing over to Stuart Hall for Cup Final, it's a knockout. I mean, it's a bit of a minefield, really, the BBC coverage of FA Cup Final there. But yeah, I mean, I think it was the BBC. As Paul says, no adverts for a starter. But you just plonked in front of the telly at 11 o'clock, ready for Cup Final. It's a knockout. Cup Final mastermind. The one player introducing all his teammates, the route to the final, all the goals from the match of the day for the season, all of that stuff. And to be fair, the BBC just had football, as Paul says. I mean, some fool at ITV had put wrestling or horse racing on or something. You can't be having that on Cup Final.
Absolutely. But I think I remember a programme one time, a retrospective of one former, another Peter Bromley, who was the head of, I think, LWT. At the time, and he said that they could compete with the BBC all the way up to kickoff, all the way up to the first advert. I think he said we're on an even keel until that first advert, and then we lost the vast majority of who we'd snared in. But yeah, absolutely outstanding stuff. Within that, the 1970s as a whole, as well, and or particular seasons that you just attach yourselves to. Your go-to player for the 1970s, both in terms of, you know, your own teams that you hold so dear to your heart, but also those that you, I don't know, you coveted or just enjoyed watching, from opposition. Dr. David, I'm coming to you first. I fully expect this to be a certain QPR showman.
Yeah, maybe. Well, now I'm going to surprise you, I think. So I'm going to do a Gary Thacker. I'll go really quickly, but three, right? So if I go QPR, I'll go Ian Gillard. And I'll go Ian Gillard because he plays for 14 years from 68 to 82. So he plays all the way through the 70s. He barely misses a game. He's a model professional, gets a ridiculously small amount of caps for England, but what a great left back. I'll leave that there. I think he plays some 485 games for QPR or something like that, which is absolutely incredible. So then I'll go foreign and domestic. Foreign very quickly. I can't really not go for Johan Cruyff. I think, Cruyff starring in the three successive European Championships and starring in the 1974 World Cup is absolutely incredible. Although having read Simon Cooper's book again today, he makes the very important point that Cruyff never really played in a great side after that season. In that season, he did star in a Barcelona side. First season he played for them. When he joined them, they were down at the bottom of the league. They won their first league in 14 years, and he culturally starts to change a region, if not a nation. So Cruyff got to be up there. And then finally, just quickly, Frank Worthington as the Maverick icon of the decade. He played for three clubs in this decade, and that was really good for him, right? Because after that, he plays for 21 in 13 years, including loan spells. He's the ultimate peripatetic striker, like have boots, will travel. But during this season, with the clubs he's with there, he's got hundreds of appearances, multiple hundreds of appearances, and hundreds of goals. He helps Huddersfield to win the second division at the start of the decade, 69-70. He helps Bolton to win the second division, 77-78. He's with Leicester for 5 years in between that. And then he's the first division top scorer in 78-79. So that's my favourite players in a nutshell.
Oh, magnificent choices all around there. Paul, same question to you. And again, you can go down the Gary Thacker route if you so wish. But I'm a Laurent Avran at the very least. One that is, that played in the colour of your own heart, and one who didn't at the very least.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the 70s were a decade of sauce up both for Everton. There's just kind of declined quite rapidly after that, unfortunately. So it's quite difficult to pick standout players, really. But part of me wants to go for Alan Ball, but in the end, he wasn't there long enough in the 70s, so I discount him on that basis. Mick Lyons is an obvious one because he was Mr. Everton all the way through the 70s, somebody you could rely upon, even to the extent of when you're getting beat 2-1 at home to throw up front for the last 5 minutes, you make something happen. But I think, looking logically, my favourite Everton player from that time would be Bob Latchford because I think for six, seven seasons, he was one of the most prolific goal scorers in the English First Division. Never got the number of caps for England that he should have done. And certainly for two seasons with Dave Thomas on the wing, that partnership with Thomas crossing the ball, and of course, Thomas ex-QPR, you well know Davis, he was such a pacey, brilliant winger. His delivery was pinpoint accurate every time, and Latchford just blossomed in that partnership. So Bob Latchford for me, from the Everton perspective. From the other clubs, I know Dave's going to go for George Best, so I won't go for George because I love George Best, but I'm not going to steal Dave's thunder there. And there were so many Mavericks who you paid to see. Like, I loved Alan Hudson, I thought he was a fantastic footballer. But if it went back to the criteria of whose name would you put the team sheet first, who would be the one you'd put in there who inspired the rest of the side, I'd go for Billy Bremner because I just think he was such a fantastic footballer. And every time, if you needed someone to stand up and be counted, if you need someone to score a crucial goal, if you need somebody to turn a losing situation into a winning situation and lead by example, to me, it would be Billy Bremner.
Excellent, excellent choices again. Dave, no pressure. There's a litany of the great and good of 1970s already mentioned. What directions are you going in?
Well, to be fair, I thought Paul was going to go for George Best. So it's very kind of him to leave George Best to me. So I can't possibly turn that down. I mean, George Best was just absolutely everything that you wanted from a footballer. He was a genius. I mean, I saw him once in his absolute prime playing for Manchester United against the Albion when I was six. And then I saw him play again in 74 or 75. Jeff Astle had a testimonial, and he knew George Best through Barry Fry, and George Best came. He was in one of his periods away from the game, shall we say. He was about 3 stone overweight, and he was the best player on the pitch by an absolute mile. I mean, they couldn't get the ball off him. I mean, the man was an absolute genius. So you can't look further than George Best, even if he only had about 18 months in the 70s, really, where he was still together. The Albion thing is a bit more difficult. I mean, because having worked there for 20 years, I got to know most of the players from the 70s. I mean, I used to drive Tony Brown around the games because he was, and he did a column for me in the programme for years. And every now and again, I'd be driving up the M1 and I'd look over them. Fucking hell, that's Tony Brown. So, I mean, yeah, he was the Albion. But I think you have to just accept, you'd have to go for Cyril Regis just for the pure excitement. There was nobody like Cyril Regis. He was a throwback to, you know, a different era. You know, they always used to say he wore a shirt that was 3 sizes too small because it would scare the opposition. It looked like he was bursting out of it. And, you know, you genuinely thought that he got changed in a phone box before the game, Cyril. I mean, that was the kind of player he was. And yeah, I did. And I got to know him really well later, and he was everything that you would want from Cyril Regis. And then, of course, you know, if we're talking about the social and political side of it, there's no bigger trailblazer than Cyril in the 70s as well. So I think you'd have to go for Cyril as the Albion.
Wonderful. All wonderful choices. The games that made the biggest impressions on you, again, both in terms of the teams you support and just the game that held you in your thrall that wasn't involving your team, which can often be, I don't know, an easier game to watch than a game that your team's involved in. You know, when you've no real discernible, you know, favouritism in the outcome of the match, you're just dragged into it by its sheer, I don't know, memorability, shall we say. Dr. David, your favourite games of the 1970s, both in terms of QPR and just you know, the impression that football left on you, you know, that game that captures your heart.
I'm going to go for the first game. Is really weird because I never saw it, and I don't think there's any footage remaining of it. But we talked in the 75-76 episode about the game where QPR, the third game of the season, go to Derby, the favourites for the league and the reigning league champions, and they beat them 5-1 at Derby. And they beat them 5-1 at Derby without 3 key defensive players who are all injured. Hollins, Webb and Hollins. So they've got this huge hole through the middle. They've got 2 teenagers in the back line instead, Abbott and Tagg. And I think it's Abbott who was a converted forward. He wasn't even a defender. Unbelievably, they win 5-1. Bob scores a hat-trick. And I think it's the moment where I'm getting shudders now, because it's the moment when you kind of think, well, hang on, something could be special here. Because they'd already beaten the German champions in pre-season, the Portuguese champions in pre-season, the German UEFA Cup holders in pre-season, and they'd beaten Liverpool, who were second the season before, and then they go to Derby and do this. So it's that moment, I think, of belief, where you think, wow, hang on, anything could happen here. And as I said in the 75-76 one, I think Abbott and Tagg went on for at least 3 more games where they still deputised, and they didn't lose any of those games, which was quite an incredible thing for that Finn squad. Then I'll broaden out, and it's fairly early in the decade, but there was a game that the Italians played, and they called it the Partita del Secolo, and the Germans called it the Jahrhundertspiel, the game of the century. And outside the Azteca Stadium is a plaque that calls it the Partita del Siglo. So this is the Italy versus West Germany semi-final for the 1970 World Cup. It starts off, as you might expect, Italy score early, put the bolt on the Catenaccio, and for the rest of the game, Germany are trying to find a way through. Germany score in the 90th plus 2 minutes to take it to extra time. We go into extra time, and that's when the game explodes. It's 4-3 after extra time to Italy. There are 5 goals in extra time, 5 goals in 7 minutes. And it swings one way and then swings the other. And the people are hosting the tournament, even though we remember it for the great winners, the great Brazil, put up the plaque and want to commemorate this great game. And that's a really nice kind of message for how football can be so powerful across cultures and can create memories for people. I mean, that's something that Jurgen Klopp talks about, isn't it? We're here to create memories, kind of create a history. And that was a really nice, exciting, unusual game to start that decade, because a lot of the scorers were very unusual scorers. One of the scorers played about 500 games, and that was one of the only two goals he scored. So it was unusual. It was the usual fare, and then it exploded. And it shows you the unpredictability of football. And it's nice to see it celebrated across national communities.
Oh, excellent choices, David. Excellent choices. Paul, same question for you. The games that have just remained with you, both in terms of an Everton fan and just a football watcher.
Yeah, in terms of the Everton games, I mean, I should go with Everton beating West Brom 2-0 to seal the league title in 1970, but I was like 14, 15 at the time, so I couldn't actually, properly celebrate that victory. So I'm kind of not included on that basis. So I'll go back to, sorry, Stephen, I know I did this about 2 weeks ago. I'm going back to 1978 Derby at Goodison Park, and Andy King hissing that rocket shots in 1978 to give Everton their first Derby win in seven seasons. And it was not just the game, it was just the celebrations afterwards. It was kind of the party that never stopped. So yeah, I definitely have to go for that one. In terms of the wider game, yeah, I mean, there's so many you can pick from, isn't there? I'll play the Gary Thacker card here. So I'll go for two. One has to be Hereford United beat Newcastle 2-1 in the FA Cup replay. That is such an iconic game. You know, with the invasion of the Parkers and everything like that, the pitch being played in an afternoon, it just had everything that a giant killing FA Cup act should contain. And because I mentioned before about how much I enjoyed the FA Cup, and the FA Cup was just an integral part of the 70s as well. I still think if you want a game that epitomises what the 1970s football stood for, if you want a game that has mavericks, that has skill, that has skullduggery, that has the game switching from end to end, has a dramatic finale, then to me, and I know it's divided by many of the modern commentators, but the FA Cup final replay 1970 between Chelsea and Leeds United, to me, is an absolute classic game that stands the test of time. It's got everything. And when you watch players these days rolling over like they're being shot, and you see players being kicked by Jack Charlton and just brushing it off and getting on with it, Peter Benassi being classic, but somehow managed to still play on and go and produce a string of brilliant saves, that game just has absolutely everything. And when people talk about the conditions weren't right for football today, the grass was too long, the wind was too heavy, watch that match and just be enthralled by the quality, the skill, and the absolute violence all contained within a glorious 120 minutes.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I can fully support this at 1970 FA Cup final replay. I've sat and watched that at least twice, two maybe three times. And there's something, if you can sit and watch it, because so much happens that you could miss it off one viewer, and you watch it again and you think, I didn't even spot that when I watched it last time. It's the punches swung at the bottom of the pitch while the ball's playing on the opposite flank. It's absolutely everything that you could want from. I mean, if anyone's seen the film Rollerball, for instance, it's kind of like this is where the inspiration for Rollerball came from. The movie The Rollerball came from. It's a true work of art. It's like football meets the Sweeney. It was truly magnificent. Truly magnificent. And I totally get your choice of the Everton derby win. A game that I think is if you can have a favourite derby defeat. I think simply, the goal that Andy King scores that day, what it meant to Everton and the iconography of the policeman bundling off the winning scorer and the interviewer on the side of the pitch is just a wonderful twist to it as well. Dave Bowler, your turn. Same question. A game of West Brom's that sticks in your memory, a game from across the wide breadth of football that you hold dear to your heart.
Well, Paul's ruined it, obviously.
That was why he gave you George Best. You said. He wasn't allowing you to have the 70 Cup final.
The hospital pass from Paul.
That was the George Best with a bit of toffee before the kind of like the daylight robbery. Yeah.
I mean, I will say, I have got another one, but I will say, my sixth birthday came right in the middle. It was the 1970 FA Cup final replay and the 1970 World Cup final. So that was a pretty good 6 weeks, really, in between there. It's got nothing to do with me, really, this game, but when Liverpool won the European Cup for the first time, that game in Rome had lots of things about it that were, you know, a quintessential 1970s football. And it was, you know, Kevin Keegan's last game as well. You know, another player I could have picked as one of my favourites from the 70s quite easily, rather than George Best. It was just in the right setting. Everything, it looked fantastic on the television. It was live, which again, you know, as I said, was a rarity in that period. And Tommy Smith scoring was just poetic. Somehow, you know, I can see Paul's not impressed, but you shouldn't have picked Chelsea Leeds, should you?
Saves revenge.
But yeah, I mean, I think that one of probably of all the European Cups that any English team has won, I think was the I was too young for the 68 Manchester United one, but of all the ones that have been won subsequently, that's the one that sort of sticks in the mind of all of them. I mean, with the Albion, there's a few, not necessarily for anything particularly great. I mean, I mentioned that time I saw George Best. That was 1971. And the Albion ground was, there were 46,000 people in the Albion ground, which is twice the capacity of what it is now, basically. And we always used to go on the Smedic end, and we got there and couldn't see a damn thing. I mean, you know, I was 5, 6, whatever it was. And I spent the game on my dad's shoulders watching this, you know, Bobby Charlton and George Best. You can't fail to love football after that, can you? And I used my time as the Albion programme writer to write a piece about that. And if you know Payne Prophet, the artist who does lots of football painting, he did a painting about it, which is now in the hallway out there. So that game sort of stands out a lot for me. In terms of the great game, I suppose it's the Valencia one in 78, 78-9. Mario Kempes came to the Hawthorns just after winning the World Cup. And we assumed that we were going to get beat. And we beat Valencia 2-0, played really well. Tony Brown scored both goals. The second one is the one that they turned into the statue that's outside the Hawthorns now. And that's based on that goal. And for about 20 minutes, we thought we were going to win something. You know, that was, God, you've beaten Valencia, who, you know, most people thought were perhaps the best team in Europe, actually, at that point. You know, the UEFA Cup, but perhaps Valencia, with Kempes and Bonoff and all that, were perhaps the best in Europe. And we felt at that point, we might go on and actually win the UEFA Cup or maybe win the league or something. Then it snowed. Nothing happened after that. It's been downhill ever since for the Albion. That was seriously, if you want to put the high point of from where everything's descended from Albion football, it was after that game at Valencia, I'd say. Or maybe the 5-3 at Manchester United about 3 weeks later. But that month, it's been downhill ever since.
Oh, there is always a zenith. And I'd just like to point out that I am wearing a retro 1977 European final. Yes, I must have sensed the answer coming in there. But yeah, I mean, that Valencia-West Brom game, it's actually the first game I remember, first European game I remember involving an English club that wasn't Liverpool. I always remember that that game and having, I think, an affinity with Valencia as well. And having, you know, I don't have a favourite Spanish club, but just having a bit of a soft spot for them simply because it was Kempes and simply because, you know, this hypnotic game had taken place and caught the imagination. You know, all excellent, excellent answers there. Moving on to what I'm building as Brian Hamilton Corner. This one's in particular for Dave Bowler, who's recently spoken to the great man. Dave, our friend Brian Hamilton, and chat about, you know, being hard done by not one but two FA Cup semi-finals throughout the 1970s.
Yeah, well, you may have already heard the episode, hopefully, with where Paul was going through some psychotherapy about the FA Cup semi-final.
Still recovering, Dave.
And Brian Hamilton's disallowed goal in the final seconds of the semi-final against Liverpool. And it just so happened I was actually speaking to Brian about a week later to do a piece for the Ipswich programme. So after I'd finished that, I mentioned to him, you know, I was just talking to this Evertonian who still hasn't recovered from Clive Thomas all these years. And he said he thinks he's got it bad. A couple of years before, when I was still at Ipswich, we were playing West Ham in the FA Cup semi-final. And Clive Thomas disallowed two goals from me on that day as well. And we got knocked out of that one as well. So Brian Anderson and Clive Thomas, not on one another's Christmas card lists. There we are.
I mean, we'll not turn this into a therapy session again for Paul, but yeah, the own Brian Hamilton story revolved around the leavers ceremony for my first year French teacher, Mr. Jones, who was a passionate Evertonian, and as way of a goodbye. And I was in a high school in Wigan at that point in time, and Brian Hamilton was the manager at Wigan Athletic, and someone had managed to swing it for Brian to come in and do the farewell presentation for Mr. Jones, handed over the carriage clock or whatever it was that was being handed over as his farewell before moving on to greener pastures. And being a cluster of Liverpool fans in the top corner of the Drama Theatre where this was taking place, and our rendition of one Clive Thomas went down particularly well, shall we say. Yeah. So we have introduced our Brian Hamilton corner, but Paul, we're not going to go into therapy sessions again.
Thank you. I was about to sign off and leave the podcast, to be honest.
Well, I think in listening terms, we have lost Aidan Williams at some point as well after the Hereford United claxon. So you know we are losing TFT. Contributors hand over first.
As long as I've got Clive lined up as a special guest on the pod at the end, you know, I wouldn't pass you this.
Yeah. This is your life, yeah. Wing it in from, yeah. Oh, fantastic. Well, right, 1970s television, we'll move on to. David, Swap Shop or Tiswas?
Tiswas, really. Who was that good-looking woman who was on it?
Sammy James.
Yeah, that'll do it for me.
Absolutely. Paul, do you concur? Are you a Tiswas or a Swap Shop man?
David, have you a Sammy James? I'm done. Sammy James Tiswas, yeah, absolutely. Saturday mornings Tiswas was just part of that routine. You come down Saturday morning, you put that on. It was funny. It was chaotic. The Swap Shop was just so staid and middle class compared to Tiswas. It was just absolute anarchy, and it's just what you wanted before going to the game in the afternoon. So, absolutely love Tiswas. Brilliant show.
Dave, are you 3 for 3 here, or are you going against the grain?
I refer you to the answers from two honourable gentlemen earlier. Sally James,
exactly. Yeah, I mean, granted, Swap Shop had Maggie Philbin, but you know, I don't know. She there's no competing with Sally James.
And she might keep checking. I mean, come on.
Absolutely. Going the opposite way, Dave Bowler, Grandstand or World of Sport?
I think probably Grandstand, just because I couldn't stand the wrestling, and there was too much wrestling on World of Sport, so we stuck with Grandstand, I think.
Paul, same to you.
The alternative sports and Grandstand were better than the wrestling on ICV. So I used to love the motorbike scrambling. That usually entertained me. The rugby league was always hilarious to watch as well. And then you go from that to the teleprinter. And no adverts as well. Once again, then no adverts was just a big selling point as well. And because those it's hard to describe now. The tension of watching the scores come up on the teleprinter, if you didn't know what the scores were. Because if you hadn't listened to it, if it wasn't a game on the radio and your only contact with what was going on was that teleprinter, that could be so nerve-wracking. You know, the last you heard you were winning 1-0, then it comes up Everton 1, Liverpool 2, you know, 2, own goal last minute. You think, oh, God, bloody typical this, you know.
David, are we 3 for 3 there? Were you a Grandstand man or a World of Sport man?
Yeah, I'll go with Grandstand. I mean, like people watching wrestling in the middle of Saturday afternoon, sitting, smoking a fag with a load of betting slips around around the chair, you know, didn't appeal to me at all. Whereas Sports Night was like Wednesday evening, right? And they did have, as Paul alluded to, kind of a bigger cultural umbrella. They'd go some places that that kind of World of Sport didn't. World of Sport was like a, it was where the soul got pulled out of culture, wasn't it? It just stayed the same forever. And people kept watching the same wrestling matches.
Yeah, I think on rainy Saturday afternoons, it would always be a case in our house of switching over as soon as the horse racing came on from like Haydock or Chepstow or whatever. What's the other side doing at the minute? And yeah, it'd often be like drag racing or something on World of Sport, or I think something like, was it like log rolling or something, or something? So always something bizarre going on World of Sport, or like Evel Knievel kind of like breaking bones or something like that, you know, beyond the wrestling as well. But yeah, very much grand in the grandstand side of the divide there.
Paul talked about the teleprinter, etc., which is a great memory.
Yes.
But, you know, when I look back to the Arsenal 70-71 season, which I was thinking about today, I used to be in my mum and dad's pub waiting for the London Evening Standard to drop through the letterbox to check all the football scores. You know, going back to Dave's point about scarcity, that thing was like diamonds dropping through the letterbox. You know, looking at all the scores, seeing what was going on the league table. So sometimes less is more, which I think is the point that Dave was talking about earlier.
And Dave's just go along with that. So particularly if you've been to the game that afternoon and you're in the pub at 6 o'clock in Liverpool, you're waiting for the football echo setter to turn up at the pub with about 50 football echoes, and they'd be gone in about 5 minutes as everyone's poured over the papers and the results.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, the pink echo was just like, yeah, go absolute gold dust. And yeah, there'd be an impatient wait for it if someone else had managed to grab it first. Dave Bowler, we'll go with Blue Peter or Magpie.
Now that's a tougher one, really. I mean, you know, John Noakes was always entertaining, wasn't he? You know, falling off something or climbing up something, getting bitten by the dog or whatever. Well, initially Blue Peter, and then, you know, probably Jenny Hanley came around about late 1970s, and maybe I switched over.
Paul, you're nodding your agreement there. I'm taking you as a Magpie man.
Jenny Handy, yeah, that's it. end of discussion. And she has her own show on Boom Radio now, you know. She's got quite a good taste in music.
Wow. Something I did not know there. And David, Dr. David, can you concur? Are you making it 3-3? This seems to be one hell of an accord going on.
No,
here.
I'm going to change.
Oh, wow.
See the Jenny Handley point, and Magpie was very refreshing and almost like a counterculture compared to Blue Peter. But Blue Peter's got it just for the zookeeper slipping in the elephant.
Yeah, classic. Absolutely. But classic.
I'm taking that we've not got a Blue Peter badge amongst the four of us, though. No, I got nowhere near it myself. Paul mentioning radio there. Dave, Radio 1 or your newfangled local commercial radio station?
I think mostly Radio 1, really. People around here will tell you about BRMB was the one, the local one. 261 BRMB radio, I can still remember the jingle. Which is amazing because you could barely hear it. I think it had a reach of about 250 yards from where it was transmitted, and the rest of it was just through static. So I think we had to stick with Radio 1.
Paul, Radio City or Radio 1? Or also was it Radio Air that would be over in Leeds or whatever?
it was Pennine Radio.
Radio.
The commercial station at that time. Radio 6 was surprisingly good for the commercial station. Particularly, the nighttime shows were very good as well. They had a DJ called Dave Lincoln, who played lots of stuff that wasn't getting played by the mainstream stations. But Radio 1, particularly for Chart Countdown and Johnny Walker. I mean, I grew up with Johnny Walker in the 70s. His show between 1 and 3, classic selection of superb tracks from the States and from the UK. And also, I mean, in the 70s, Radio Luxembourg was still going, so that was also a nighttime listener as well, so that was still worth tuning into. Because Radio 1 at nighttime, to me, didn't have anything after about 6 o'clock. So that's where Radio City and possibly Radio Luxembourg came into their own.
Did its thing. David, Capital or Radio 1?
Do you know, I don't remember listening to radio at all at that point, and I'm going to replace it with an anecdote. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. As many of things are with Stan Bowles. But apparently Stan Bowles and Don Shanks have laid a bet on a dog, during Saturday. Surprise, surprise. And there's a corner for the opposition, right? And in those days, it's quite cosy, Loftus Road. You can hear the radio in the crowd. and they hear the race about to start with a dog that they've got a lot of money on. And the opposition kick the corner in, and they keep knocking it off for another corner while the radio transmission is still going on until they hear the result. That's the story. Whether it's true, I don't know, but it's a nice one.
Oh, magnificent, magnificent. And back to football. I'll go back with you, David, here. Match of the day, I think it would be the big match for you on a Sunday afternoon, wouldn't it?
Well, big match was the one that first came on that colour telly, and that's what got me embroiled in football. I've never been unembroiled, if that's a word, since. But I guess, you know, match of the day always for me has that bit more gravitas. I liked Brian Moore's commentary. I think we talked about Brian Moore earlier. But match of the day just seems to have more about it for me generally. I don't know whether that's true at the time, but it is now.
That was one for match of the day. Paul, match of the day or the kickoff match?
Well, we've had this discussion before, Stephen, that so that those who live near the coast on Merseyside, we turned our aerial a certain way, we could hit the Harlech television, and Harlech television used to show the big match on Sunday afternoon. So unless Everton were on the kickoff game, we'd always watch the big match. Yeah, I see the arguments on both sides here, but to me, the big match just looked far more modern in its presentation than what match of the day did. I loved the interviews on the big match. You listened to Alan Ball talking about giving sort of good kick at the end during the game because he was annoying him. They're much more open and forthright. I loved the bit where Brian Moore's got the postcards and he reads out letters from people, reads out their name and address and their house number. You know, without a care in the world, it really was of its age. But also, they used to show three games on the big match, where I think Match of the Day was kind of limited to two at that time. So I'd have to go for the big match. And of course, I think even at that time, if you got the Radio Times, they couldn't tell you what was on Match of the Day. So there'd be a cryptic description of what the game would be. So today's game features a lead Northwestern First Division team who are facing a tough game against a team battling against relegation. So you could kind of work out from that, you know, what the game was going to be. And it was definitely a thing in those days as well that, you know, if one of your friends off the ground there and saw the BBC cameras there, the dream say, look, the game's on Match of the Day tonight, so I just let you know the cameras are here.
Going back to the video printer, that was another giveaway when they'd be doing kind of like, and we'll just go to such and such.
that's right.
Over the ground. And if it was just a picture of said reporter, then you knew that wasn't going to be on Match of the Day. But if it was kind of like, and we'll just go to Barry Davis at Stamford Bridge, and then you'd see pictures of the players walking off. But we can't tell you what's on Match of the Day tonight, but we can show you a very, very visual clue of what's going to be on Match of the Day tonight. Dave, Match of the Day or Star Soccer? You have the swinging vote here.
I think probably Match of the Day. I mean, Star Soccer was... Gary Newbon was a big player in Star Soccer. And he always seemed to want to go to the baseball ground. And that could have been boring after a while. It's in Derby County every other week on Star Soccer. So I think Match of the Day was the one, just because you got such a wide variety of games, you know. I mean, Star Soccer was great in that, and I think all the ITV ones were probably the same. They had to occasionally show, you know, like Walsall in the third division or the fourth division, wherever they were. Port Vale would be on occasionally. So that was great. And Hugh Johns was a decent commentator. He got the ITV gig on World Cup final day, didn't it? When everybody else was listening to Kenneth Walster now. but I think probably Match of the Day, just on the basis that it was a wider variety of games. Because you always think, you know, oh, this is the regional one, we'll be on this week. And we always never seem to be on. It always used to be Derby County.
So Match of the Day just wins that. The only one that went to a deciding vote there, actually. I think we'll find that. One that we threw in, or I threw in very late in the day. And Paul, you might have not even seen this one, so I allow you a pass on this one. Was memorabilia corner. Some 1970s memorabilia, if you had it to hand to grab it. I'll start off with the 1970 World Cup Esso collection.
Wow, fantastic.
A complete set there. Fully resplendent with the erroneous coin that stated that Bobby Moore had won a CBE rather than an OBE, with an accompanying 100 years of football SO1 as well, which had a kind of like a coin. Oh, the excellent snap, which has a coin for every FA Cup winner up to 1972, as traditionally, you know, handed on from I don't know, an uncle or a family member. Dave, have a spiked your guns there.
Well, mine was the 1972 FA Cup centenary with all the medals, which was, I think was Esso who put in, I was like, you had to buy, you know, 4 gallons of four star or whatever it was to get a, you know, to get your medal. And I used to say, you know, Dad, can we go to Esso to fill up? Which was a blow because we didn't get a car till 1973.
Fantastic.
I did manage to get the bloke next door managed to get me a complete set of the medal. So I found it again about 3 or 4 years ago. But it's a great thing. Actually, it's got a nice little book with it, and then all the medals are still there, resplendent. So yeah, that's quite a nice little piece of memorabilia.
Brilliant stuff. Brilliant stuff. David, Dr. David, what have you brought our show and tell, our special 1970s show and tell section? Yeah.
Well, my wife has been living with me too long. She once bought me a history of Argentinian football for Christmas. It was about 800 pages long. But she managed to get me this, which is, I'll just show you the cover. You can probably see QPR and David Thomas.
Oh, wow.
It's The Facts About a Football Club featuring Queen's Park Rangers with an introduction by Bobby Charlton. I don't know if you can see this picture, but I'll try and bring it up. That's Don Masson.
Oh, wow.
Training at Wormwood Scrubs, where there's an athletics field, in about 75, 76. And he's being trained by someone called Ron Jones, who was an Olympic gold medal sprinter, who was working with the club, very early athletics fitness director. Gordon Jago got him in before Dave Sexton, to be fair. I had the privilege of interviewing Ron Jones shortly before he died a couple of years back. I've got a lovely interview with him that I'm writing up as part of that journal article we're talking about. So that's a really nice treasured thing. And just quickly, I've got a copy of Tackle Soccer by Dave Sexton as well, which is a great coaching book. It's meant to be Roy Hodgson's favourite coaching book. And there's some really nice insights into Dave Sexton's philosophy and practices as a coach.
Wonderful. A wonderful selection. And Paul, like I say, did you manage to find,
yeah.
Did you see the message?
I managed to grab a few things that I was at hand. So just bear with me on this, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Okay, so certainly... Football magazines in the 70s, Goal magazine, they're definitely the best magazine. That and Soccer Star were the two best magazines in the 60s and 70s, in my humble opinion. I'm quite a saddo for the World Cup thing. So there's my World Soccer 1978 Brazil World Cup special, giving you all the runners and riders for that. There was a thing where fans would make records recording their memories of important games. That's Everton supporters 1966, all memories of the FA Cup final win against Sheffield Wednesday with an A and a B-sider and a club remix as well. Back at Park Avenue, their last league season in the Football League, used to produce a fanzine. That's their supporters club magazine. So that's one of my pride and joys, saddo that I am. And, no 70s experience was complete without the Football League view inside your programme with the obligatory advert for Park Drive on the back as well, which is just absolutely brilliant. And, just one last one. When Everton played Leeds United, the season after Leeds won the league, and they featured Billy Bremner holding the league title up on the front cover, which, given the animosity between both teams, must have been a brave decision on the part of the editor at that time, but I suppose he's under pressure to do so.
Excellent, excellent horde of things. I think Paul wins the day there. I think we've all come up with something fantastic, though. Absolutely wonderful collection of 1970s memorabilia. Moving on to our quiz round. We're going for a quiz round here. And these questions all come from a match programme involving your own team at Anfield during the 1970s. First up, Paul McPartland. 1975-76, Liverpool versus Everton. April 1976, an early kickoff. I think it was possibly Grand National Day. This was an 11:15 kickoff. A goalless stalemate until David Fairclough popped up with an absolutely astounding winning goal with just a couple of minutes to go. Do find it on YouTube. YouTube quacks on there. Paul doesn't have to do that. Ken McNaught. Everton lost Ken McNaught at half-time. Roger Kenyon coming on to replace him in this game. And it was, I say, David Fairclough got this magical winner. The average age of the Everton side for this game was 24.82, for those who like to know such things. The average age of the Liverpool starting lineup, 26.88. Phil Neal missed a late penalty, which would have rubbed salt into the wound a little bit further there. It was a game that was, sorry, Dr. David, but, you know, very, very, very pivotal in Liverpool. The run into the 75-76 league title. But, Paul, here we go for your 10 questions. Which country was the last to win the European Nations Cup? Bearing in mind, this is now I'm asking you these questions in April 1976.
So you're talking 1972, so you're talking West Germany?
We are, West Germany. They beat Russia, as they are being denoted in the answers here, 3-0 in Brussels. Where did the final take place? Oh, I'll just give the answer.
Munich.
No, Brussels. Name the first club to win the UEFA Cup.
Juventus.
Tottenham Hotspur. Defeating Wolves 3-2 in the 1972 final. Which club won the FIRS Cup the most number of times?
Oh, yeah, that one, Stephen. I'll take a wild guess on this one. Leeds United.
Ooh, Barcelona. Really? Very narrow. But yeah, it was a narrow thing. It is an epically tough one. Some of these questions are massively unforgiving. In what year were goalposts invented?
1875.
They were invented in...
You're not moving them, are you?
1890. Within the ballpark. Name the first division club to climb from fourth division to first.
Oh, that'd be Carlisle.
This would be the first team. The first team to go from fourth to first.
Oh, that'd be Northampton Town.
Northampton Town. Name the record scorer for league games in the fourth division. Name the record scorer for league games in the fourth division, as in, you know, most goals in one given season, I think.
Yeah. I think this is between two. I think this is between Kevin Hector and Terry Bly. I'll go for Kevin Hector.
Terry Bly.
I knew she was one of those two.
Excellent work. The ex-Peter of players, leading scorer in the fourth division with 52 goals.
Yeah, in their first season in the Football League. Yeah.
Which were the countries that met in the Tokyo Olympics football final?
Steve, I've no idea.
Go Eastern Europe. It's an iron curtain clash.
East Germany.
No, Hungary and Czechoslovakia. When did the white ball first come into use?
Nice. White ball first came to use 1951.
And in season 1972-73, Liverpool won the league title, but who were the runners-up?
Leeds.
Arsenal. So Paul is our early pace setter with a terrible 3 out of 10. Next up into the hot seat. How much pressure was on that, Paul?
Oh, an awful lot.
I was sweating for you there.
It was worse to be there than the 76 semi-final.
I've even got an Ertex football shirt on as well. I shouldn't be feeling the heat at all. Yeah. So Dave Bowler's up next. This is from Liverpool versus West Brom, January 1977.
I can tell you this before we start, as a programme editor of the past, if you try to put a quiz that difficult in a programme editor.
Well, this one comes from a 1-1 draw between the two teams. David Cross is on target for West Brom in the 82nd minute opens the scoring in what is going to be a huge win for West Brom, only for David Fairclough to poop the party to a degree 2 minutes later with the equaliser. In this game, Paddy Mulligan limped out after just 17 minutes to be replaced by a certain Brian Robson. The average age of the West Bromwich Albion's lineup that day, 28.24, compared to a Liverpool starting lineup of average age of 25.95. Liverpool were top of the table after this match with West Brom in ninth. Dave, are you ready?
As I'll ever be.
Can you name the last player to score a hat-trick in a cup final at Wembley? Bear in mind, I'm asking you these questions in January 1977.
than what.
In a cup final, you've got to listen to the question.
The trick.
Yeah.
Trick
Can
question.
You name the last player to score a hat trick in a cup final?
Jeff Earlstream,
No, Ted Dickett for Skelmersdale United at the 1971 Challenge Trophy. Again, an unforgiving quiz. Who were the last pair of brothers to appear in the same team in an FA Cup final?
Well, it's been nice doing this series. We'll see you later, listeners, for the 1980s.
What's notable is that no one's actually kind of like claiming that they've written these questions either.
Yes, I'm not surprised. They'd never get out alive. Wasn't there a Blade brothers? Was it for Newcastle? That wouldn't be right. That's my guess, but there we are.
It was Alan and Ron Harris for Chelsea in the 1967 final against Spurs. What is the record win for a British Football League team against foreign opposition?
Paul's looking pretty safe on three.
If you get this, I will be absolutely stunned. So, yeah, you're thinking you've got to go esoteric here. That this is nothing to do with kind of like European club competition whatsoever. We're talking kind of like post-war friendlies.
Leicester City 14.
Leicester City 14. There is a possibility that Dr. David's dad might have gone and watched this game.
Arsenal 14. I'm giving up.
Arsenal 25, a Parisian 11. One.
I was only 11 out.
You're only 11
I'm
out.
I'm the opposition, obviously.
Name the footballer who played in all four divisions within 12 months.
Dear God.
This is even worse than Paul's set of questions.
I know. So I was thinking. They obviously didn't like the Albion. Ray Crawford.
Tony McNamara played for Everton in the first, Liverpool in the second, Bury in the third, and Crewe in the fourth. Which player holds the record for scoring the highest number of goals in an FA Cup tie?
See, I would have known that when I was 15. No idea now. All the brain cells have died out.
Now, this did happen in the 1970s at the very least.
It's Ted McDougall.
It's Ted McDougall. He scored for a bonus point. Who did he score his goals for and against?
Bournemouth against
for Bournemouth.
Like Margate or something.
Margate, oh, excellent. I'm giving you, there's a bonus point for Dave there. Which former Scotland international player gained three FA Cup winners' medals at Wembley? And he's a name that has been, you know, synonymous with this podcast. You know, he has tipped up upon occasion.
No.
Dave Mackay for Spurs, 1961.
I was going to say Dave Mackay as well. That's a great idea.
Name the last player to score a hat-trick against Liverpool at Anfield. I would not even have got this.
I go for something blindingly obvious like, I don't know, Dennis Law.
Terry Alcock for Norwich in 1962. Who scored the goal? Oh, here we go. Dave's got the finally. Who scored the goal which won the FA Cup for Southampton against Manchester United last season?
Bobby Stokes. That should have been the first question.
That would have set there. Which present First Division club has won the Amateur Cup? Remember, this is January 1977.
We'll pass that on to Paul for a bonus because he's got his hand up.
Oh, is he for a bonus point, Paul?
Yeah. Is it Middlesbrough?
It is Middlesbrough. Paul for the steal. Moves him up to 4 out of 10. Okay, and your final question, Dave. Name the club that won the FA Cup and had to apply for re-election in the same season.
That would be in the 1890s or something, probably, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be.
It wouldn't be Wolves, would it?
No, it would actually be West Brom in 1892.
Ah, well, that's not strictly true.
Oh!
There's an error there because we played in the test matches. Didn't apply for re-election. We played in the end-of-season test matches. Liverpool, right to that programme editor.
I will get in touch with them and say, hey, what's this all about? I know it
feels like that Monty Python thing where, you know, Karl Marx has to decide when the Coventry City last win the FA Cup to win a lounge suite.
Right, okay. I'm going to give Dave an extra point there for kind of like pulling up the quiz master. So that brings you level with Paul on 4 out of 10. Dr. Dave, there's absolutely no pressure on this except to go immortality.
Well,
That's all
blimey,
this.
Stephen, these are difficult questions, mate.
These are massively difficult.
With my rock and roll lifestyle, what I normally do is play the misses at University Challenge on a Monday night, and I've got a feeling I'm going to get as many questions right. Anyway, carry on.
I know. I mean, I was watching a bit of Mastermind before we came on to record this, and I actually got 3 questions right in a row. I was quite stunned. Other than that, was easier than these quiz questions. Dave, your set of questions come from the match day programme from QPR's 1-0 defeat at Anfield on Saturday, December the 17th, so a week before Christmas, 1977. A 1-0 win for Liverpool, in which Phil Neal scored the only goal from the penalty spot. Barry Wallace lasted 76 minutes before being replaced by Martin Busby. Frank Sibley is the QPR manager. There is an average age of the Liverpool lineup of 26.58 compared to the average age of the QPR lineup at 25.29. After the match, Liverpool are third and QPR in a troublesome 19th position. Okay, so there's the wider insignificant facts of the game. Okay, question number one. When was the last, bear in mind, we are in December 1977. When was the last time all the goals in an FA Cup final were scored in extra time? The answer is within the 1970s.
69-70.
It's 1971.
Oh, of course it is.
Yeah.
God. Highway, yeah. Charlie George and Eddie Kelly or George Graham, depending
or
on
George, yeah.
Which you read. Yeah.
Indeed. Can you name the first second division club to win the FA Cup?
I'll go with Sunderland. It's probably somebody before that.
I think if I've got my facts right here, it was actually one within the city of Liverpool, isn't it?
It was one within the city of Liverpool.
Yeah, I think this final took place at Goodison Park. If I got it right.
Someone like Bury in the past, or
Notts County in 1894. Who was the goalkeeper who fainted at the end of the 1934 FA Cup final? As a clunking clue, he was an England international later in his career, and as in his duties as a journalist, didn't survive the Munich air disaster.
No, unfortunately, I don't know the name. I'm not going to get it. But we've got a bonus one there.
Frank Swift. Oh, we've got a bonus one.
You're going to say Frank Swift?
You're going to say Frank Swift?
Yeah,
I accept Paul's honesty there.
Because he played in the final year before against Everton when they lost 3-0.
Ah, very good. That moves Paul ahead. Okay, question number four. Which is the only club to have played in all 6 divisions of the Football League? We have mentioned this club within the 1970s series. Paul's got his hand up for a rather unscrupulous survival from relegation.
No, I don't think I'm going to get it. Give him the bonus.
I'm going for Paul. Paul?
Coventry City.
Coventry City.
Great knowledge.
Excellent work from Paul there. What is the record attendance at a game played on British soil involving an English league club? And again, this is in relation to a game that took place in the 1970s against another British club.
98,000?
134,000 for
wow.
The second leg of the European Cup semi-final play between Celtic and Leeds United at Hampden Park in 1970. Which footballer played in an FA Cup final at Wembley both as an amateur and as a professional? Good God, this quiz is unremitting. I think whoever was doing the Liverpool quiz questions between 1975-76 and 1977-78 had anger management issues.
This has got to be pretty early on then.
But it's post-World War II, though.
Okay.
Paul's sweeping in there.
Go on then, Paul.
It's a guess, this. I've put the name wrong, but I think he played for Man United. Is it Warren Bradley or someone like that?
Oh, no. Good guess, though. Bill Slater.
Right, now.
Played for Blackpool as an amateur in the 1951 final and for Wolves in the 1960 final as a fully paid professional. Number seven. Can you name the two clubs that have defeated Liverpool in the Charity Shield? One was a club that Bill Shankly had managed prior to being Liverpool manager. And the other, your favourite non-QPR 1970s player played for these during the 1970s. In fact, he played for both of these clubs during the 1970s.
My favourite non oh, okay. Right.
If you go back to your non...
Huddersfield and Bolton then.
Oh, no, go.
Oh, Huddersfield and Leicester.
Yes, correct. Huddersfield and Leicester. And given,
that's what
given
I meant to say.
That's two clubs you're answering there, so that's 2 points. I'm 2 points for that one.
Very generous.
In which years, bear in mind, December 1977. In which years does Brazil win the World Cup?
1970.
Yep.
And 58.
58. And there is and one more.
Oh, you want three?
Uh-huh.
So 70, 58, 54?
Paul's got his hand raised. He's going to sweep in.
Yes, 62.
I'm giving Paul an extra point there, but I'm giving Dr. Dave 2 points for his correct answers. Okay, penultimate question. What is the highest recorded score in an FA Cup tie? Oh, Paul might know this. And you've got to think in esoteric terms. In esoteric goal scoring terms and in terms of one team keeping a clean sheet as well.
36-0, but I think that's the overall record of all time.
That's the bomb accord, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Paul, can you swoop on this one?
Yeah, Preston North End 26, Harrington 19-0.
Exactly. Great work, Paul. And the final question. A lot of pressure on this one now, Dr. Dave. Which was the last First Division team to reach double figures in a league game? Bear in mind that quite a bit of your early footballing experiences took place in North London. It's another North London based club.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's Tottenham, right?
It is Tottenham Hotspur. Excellent work. And can you advance that on what it might have been, the scoreline might have been? I did not realize this before.
This is delivered, Steve. So it's Tottenham 10, Everton 4, Bill Nicholson's first game in charge as manager.
It is Tottenham 10, Everton 4, a Whiteout Lane in 1958. Sorry.
Yeah.
And I can properly assure you that I couldn't have written that any more mischievously. I'd have tried, and that has been an effortless slur there that have ended the quiz off. But brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Our winner. Our champion for the 1970s quiz. And the difficulty of those questions was just absolutely abysmal. It's Paul with 8 out of 10 who defeats Dr. David in second place and 5 out of 10. And our producer extraordinaire and contributor extraordinaire, Dave Bowler, limping home in fourth place. I was even downing you down to fourth place there, Dave. I do apologise.
Wait till I've edited it, I've won.
But well done, everyone. But no, thank you so much. That has been an excellent finish to a wonderful rap party. Dave Bowler, the series in general and the rap party particular.
It's been a great series, I think. It's been a big success, really. And possibly one more episode still to come. Under wraps, but no, it's been good fun tonight, and kind of what the 70s were about. Not too seriously, not taking ourselves too seriously. I think that's the great joy of the 70s.
Absolutely, we've given the listeners a fuller kind of view of the personalities we've got with our viewing and listening preferences as well. I think there. Paul McParlan, thank you so much. And I do apologise for the Tottenham 10, Everton 4 question at the very end. But your trophy is in the post as 1970s quiz. I can see why your son ended up on University Challenge, to be quite honest.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. It's been an absolutely brilliant series. I mean, there's that quote, isn't it, that if you can remember the 60s, you did, then you didn't live in the 60s. Well, I think we proved that wrong for the 70s. You know, we lived through the 70s and we remembered all those key games in the 70s. Fantastic, fantastic decade of football. It's been great reliving the stories with yourself, with Dr. Davis, with Dave. Thanks to you for hosting and putting us together. I've still got a bit of a bugbear about some of the focus of your questions, picking some of your quiz questions, but I'm prepared to let that go in the interest of sporting bonhomie between us all. And as soon as this is over, I'm juggling before Capri. I'm off to a post-pod party with Pans people, and you read about it tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely outstanding. And Dr. David, is it the Allegro you've come in tonight?
No, not at all. It's been great fun revisiting the 70s. I had a Vauxhall Viva then, I think, if I look
Vauxhall Viva.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's been great fun. And it's been great fun kind of reconnecting with the joy that is the 1970s. There was a naivety. And as we've said, some of the things weren't as good. You know, the grounds and the pitches and the violence. But there was a lot of things that were good that you can reconnect with things like this. And as you said, it's very nice to bring the younger generation up with some of the things that preceded modern football, but also to connect people who remember those times with those memories. And I guess we ought to say, not to be a downer, but we need to think about our heroes from this generation who suffer sadly from dementia. You know, there's many of our heroes that have died from that and are suffering from it now. And I think it's a combination perhaps of those heavy footballs and the lifestyle that they had in those days. But it's a terrible shame when your heroes are all like that. But, you know, the best thing we can do is remember them in their prime. And that's the greatest respect we can give them.
Absolutely. Wonderful sentiments as well there. And Dave Bowler, what car are you off to? Obviously, with no seatbelt on and having drunk the entirety of that party, that Watney's party 7.
Well, the first car my dad ever had when he did finally pass his test, we had a Morris Minor, so that'll do. That'll do nicely.
Excellent. Painted like was it Sid James' son? And bless his house.
No, it was grey. So Rodney Marsh was right.
A grey car, right? Right. But brilliant stuff. Oh, thank you so very much, everyone, for all your efforts throughout tonight and the series as well. And a big thanks for Gary Thacker, who couldn't be with us tonight as well, who came off the bench a couple of times as well across the series. And to the listeners as well, thank you so much. For sticking with it all the way through, if that's what you've done. And if you haven't, if you just tripped across us, then do go back and listen through. We've had an absolute ball doing this, whether anyone's listening or not, I think, to be quite honest. But all it leaves for me to say is thank you so much to everyone. And this has been a These Football Times production. We shall see you again very, very soon. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.